This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you with me for the next hour. You, of course, are listening to the show all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest has saddled 534 winners coming into today's show, but I promise you, none bigger than his talented two-year-old filly, California Angel, the daughter of Kentucky Derby winner California Chrome, unleashed a hellacious late run. That's the only way to describe it. It was incredible to win the Grade 2 Bourbon Stakes at Keeneland on October 13th. That win, which catapulted her into the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies turf last weekend, was really special for my guest here today. And although it wouldn't be her day in the Breeders' Cup last weekend, it's an experience that her 55-year-old trainer would never trade for anything, I can promise you. It is a fantastic story. Please join me in welcoming trainer George Leonard III to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. George, appreciate the visit.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, really excited to hear your story and to talk a little bit about California Angel. I'm sure she's quickly become one of your favorite subjects to talk about now.
Yes, she is. I mean, she's special, and we're super glad to have her, and it's always good to talk about her.
You are based at Indiana Grand, but you're still in California some, I guess, 4 or 5 days after the Breeders' Cup now. And I was kidding with you before we came on the air, and I said, what, are you taking a little vacation there in the Golden State? and you said, no, I'm just waiting for her to ship back.
All right. Plane, we're waiting for the plane, and she ships out tomorrow. They wanted me to ship her the same night that she ran, and I refused. I said, wait for another plane. So it was a few days before the next plane, so we waited a few days.
Yeah. What have you done with her in the meantime? Did she just stay at Del Mar, or did you have to move her?
No, she stayed at Del Mar. We just walked her here at Del Mar and just give her a little time off.
How come you were against sending her back right after the race? Is that not good for a horse?
Well, I don't know. For some horses, you know, some horses get stressed after they run. You know, I don't know how she was going to come back. You know, she was stressed and tired and, you know, just not ready to travel. I didn't want to have her plane, but she had to leave that early in the morning, so I prefer to give her a little time to settle down and, you know, come out of the race, okay?
You know, her race in the Jessamine Stakes was so incredible. I use the word hellacious to describe that stretch run because she closed like a freight train, and I want to talk to you about that race, but I want to talk to you first about the experience of being at the Breeders' Cup. She finishes 11th in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf. I know you're trying to win every race you're in, but man, you got to be so proud of this little filly.
I was proud. I was pleased. You know, I wanted her to finish a lot better, but we had a really rough trip. You know, it's not to make excuses. She just got hung wide, bumped around a little bit, and she made a little run, but still wide in the last turn. She just got the worst of it. But, you know, that's racing. She still tried, but, you know, it just wasn't her day. Things just didn't work well for us.
When you saw that she drew post position number 14, that was the outside post in the field. Mm-hmm. What went through your mind, George?
Well, I tried to stay optimistic. When she drew the 14, I said, well, we'll have a straight pad there. You know, just there's nothing I could do about it at the time, so I just had to try to remain positive and look at the good side of it, hoping she could break and get out and get us a little position. From there, you know, just work with what we had. You know, there's nothing I could do anymore from there. So I just had to remain positive and try to look at the good side of it.
How'd she come out of the race?
came out of the race fine. Came out of the race well. Thankful for that. So we'll see what comes up here in the future. Give her a little time off and get her started back and see where we go with her next.
Yeah, what do you think the future might hold for her?
Hard to tell. I hadn't planned. You know, it's all was like a dream just to get here. You know, things just happen so fast. Boom, she wins. She wins here. Then we end up coming to California. So haven't had time to sit down and talk with the owners and discuss a path for her as of yet. You know, we were just so ecstatic about being here. We just focused totally on being here. We didn't go to anything after this.
Yeah, you know, that's such a great point. And I don't think people realize this, George, that when a trainer, especially a trainer like yourself who has, what, 19 horses in your barn, and you get a right. horse like this and she jumps up and she wins the Jesmond Stakes, a grade two, that's a win in your end for the Breeders' Cup. All of a sudden, you're making plans, you're scheduling things that you weren't necessarily anticipating you were going to have to. What are those couple of weeks like in between the Jesmond and the Breeders' Cup for a trainer that's kind of a smaller operation like yours?
Well, for me, it was a little stressful. You know, it's just you're filling out paperwork and sending applications, and there's lots of paperwork to get to the Breeders' Cup that is just not in the norm for me. You know, these are just things that I don't usually deal with. This is not a everyday occurrence and, you know, things that I'm used to dealing with, you know. So I had to – it was a little tough getting everything situated to get here and trying to crutch everything done right to make it here in time and get everything in order.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, George, and say that you'll be happy to have to deal with those things every year from now on, right?
Oh, most definitely. You know, it's something that you know, it's like your dream. Then when you get it, it's a lot bigger than what you really thought. You know, after you get this opportunity, then there are so many things you have to, like you say, you start scheduling a flight for a horse, which is something I don't do every day, you know. I gotta start scheduling so many different things, and it's a good kind of extra work.
Visiting with trainer George Leonard III here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. He, of course, made his first appearance in the Breeders' Cup with California Angel this past weekend. And George, you mentioned you used the word dream to describe what the Breeders' Cup appearance was like for you. And I said it was more like a David versus Goliath type of story when it comes to you and even to California Angel. You grew up in the small town of Elton, Louisiana. You have 19 horses in your barn at your home base of Indiana Grand, and your team is essentially you and your wife, Isabel. So what was this whole experience like for you the past week or so?
It was gratifying. You know, we worked hard. We spent a lot of tough days. I have a couple different people that work for me now, you know, a few more people, but there was many days when it was just me and my wife. You know, it was trouble to get help. Nobody went to work. Nobody was around. So, you know, this was gratifying, you know, for watching all our work come together. You know, we got to be recognized for some of the work that we did.
Yeah, you know, the other thing is you're also dealing with a lot more attention than you're used to dealing with, say, on a Tuesday or a Wednesday at Indiana Grand. All of a sudden, there are reporters coming by to talk with you. Everybody's talking about the filly as maybe, you know, one of the horses that can win the Juvenile Fillies Turf. And there's all these expectations, too, that you have to deal with, right?
Right, that it is, you know. And, you know, for me, it's almost a little embarrassing. You know, you don't want to brag like, oh, my God, I got this monster horse, you know. And there's cameras and there's reporters, there's questions and questions. And, you know, you're hoping for the best. But, you know, when you're racing, it can be your day and it can not, you know, just like it was for her. It just didn't work. Days like that happen in racing.
So I also work with my wife. She helps me here with the Horse Racing Radio Network. So I know what it's like to work alongside your spouse. How about for you guys? How does this whole thing work out for you and for Isabel? How have you been able to make it work for so long?
Well, she puts up with me.
I would say the same thing.
I'm serious about my business, and sometimes, you know, when things go bad, you know, things are rough, I'm stressed, and she puts up with me. I'm blessed that she does put up with me, because as in anything, you know, things don't always go smooth and you have to tough things out, but she's been right there for me all the way through it. I'm blessed to have her.
What is her role in your operation and the two of you working together? What things does she handle?
She handles most of paying the bills and keeping everybody paid. She hot walker. She does pretty much everything around the barn.
Wow. And she's a California girl, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, she is.
So mm-hmm. This was a homecoming for her.
Yep, she loved it here.
Wow. What part of California did she grow up in?
Glendale, California.
Okay. So here's you from a small town in Louisiana, and here's Isabel from California. How did the two of you meet? Was it a racetrack romance?
We met at Turfway Park.
Okay.
I was at Turfway. I was running some horses at Turfway, and she happened to be in there, and we ran into each other and met, and then we've never left. She's been with me ever since.
Wow. Outstanding. You know, I saw an interview that you did this past week with my good friend Jenny Reese, and she did an interview with Isabel as well. And when she talked to Isabel, she said that you knew after California Angels first work that you had something special. And then she went on to talk about the fact that the two of you look at your horses that you train as your children. Is that accurate?
Yes, they are. They're like our kids. You know, you got to love what you do. And our horses are special to us.
So are you more of a coach or are you more of a parent figure for these horses that you're working with?
I'd like to say a combination because, you know, they need both. You have to coach them and discipline as you go along, you know, teach them what you want them to do. And it's a combination.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It's kind of a crossover between the two, I guess.
Right.
Back to that first work, she said that you knew right away when California Angel worked the first time that you might have something special there. What was it that gave it away?
Well, she worked awfully good, fast, and, you know, the horses I put her with, she just toyed with them. And I said, either this horse is special or I'm just missing something here. Maybe the ones I worked with are not that good, but then every time after that I worked her, she just improved and improved, and I realized that there was something different about this horse. She was special.
You've been around some pretty good horses in the past. Are there things that good horses do or characteristics that they have that set them apart from an ordinary horse?
You can see the difference. I mean, she did what she did, never tired. You know, she beat the other horses working with easy, with no effort, and she'd come back, you know, unfazed by the work, you know, and just you can tell there's a difference in night and day in the average horses and one that's above average.
Did I read somewhere, George, that you said after her first work you had to kind of question yourself in what you were seeing because you weren't sure if it was her or if the other horses she was working with maybe weren't all that good?
Yep, I did. I was like, she can't be that good. Maybe the horse just that bad. But no, it wasn't that. It was her. The ones that I worked with turn around and won right quick. I won races with them right quick, and she just toyed with them, so it just showed me I wasn't wrong. She was just better than the average.
I mentioned in the open that, you know, this was kind of a David versus Goliath scenario with you and with California Angel because, look, I mean, you were in this race with some pretty big names, names like, you know, Chad Brown, for example, and Brad Cox and you know, Christophe Clement, who ended up winning that race. But you're in this race. You're there with all these big names on the training side. But poor California Angel, you paid $5,500 for her. So she steps in there with horses that cost much more than that. So it is kind of a David versus Goliath situation for both of you. Tell me the story of how you found California Angel.
Well, I found California Angel. I looked at her, and I looked through, and she was a horse that, in my line of operation, I had to be honest, you know, I had to look for a horse that I can afford because I don't have that much money to spend. So, you know, I try to look for something that I can bid on, something that's going to go in my price range, something that I can afford to buy. So I saw that she had a sister that hadn't won a lot of money and was just hopeful that maybe this one might go for a decent price where we can afford to get this one. And it all worked out. She did. She went cheap and got lucky to get her.
Yeah, you talked about the characteristics that good horses have as opposed to an ordinary horse. Can you tell that at a sale like that too, George?
Yes and no.
Sort of.
A lot of it, you know, you look at how a horse walks, how they carry themselves, you know, if they're athletically made, if they walk like an athlete, or some horses walk where they don't really look like they're very athletic. I think it's just you get a feel for what you're looking for in a racehorse.
Why do you think she only sold for $5,500?
Like I said before, I think it's because of her sister. She had a pool sister that didn't make much money.
Yeah.
So the pool sister didn't make much money. You wouldn't think that the next one's going to make much money either.
Yeah, her owner, Chris Walsh, has a breeding operation in Indiana. Tell me a little bit more about that relationship, and what did Chris say when you told him that, hey, we got one?
She was happy to have a chrome. She said we've always wanted a chrome. She was very happy when I told her that I bought a California chrome for her. We've been friends for a long time. You know, I've been knowing her and her husband for years. You know, we'd always talk and have a conversation at the racetrack. And the year before California Angel, they sent me a horse, which didn't work out. He got sore and ended up having to be turned out. But next year they decided that when I went to the sale, if I could buy him one. So I called him when I got back and told him that I found him a California chrome. She was extremely happy.
Why was California Chrome the one that captured everybody's heart?
What I like about him, I think he was so pretty. He was a beautiful horse. And he lasted long. He got better as he got older to me. And he was just a people's horse. You know, it was so good to have a horse to keep running. We all had to see these horses that run 3-4 times, 6-8 times, and then they retired to stud, you know. He just kept running and running year after year, went all over the world and just made money. I think that was captivating to a lot of people, you know, to have a star that they could keep seeing over and over again.
Yeah, it's a great point, because so often the stars of our sport are gone to stud after their 3-year-old season. If they make it to 4, that's a long career now.
That's right. And, you know, he ran until he was 5-6 years old. You know, and he just got better and better.
You know, I developed a very close friendship with Alan Sherman, the son of Art Sherman. And Alan and Art were together through that entire run for California Chrome. We broadcast the Triple Crown races on radio here on HRN. But, you know, Alan was so excited when he saw California Angel win the Jessamine the way she did. He was just over the moon for California Chrome to have a daughter this good. And am I not mistaken, too, George, didn't Art come see her at the barn?
Yes, I did. I met him. He came by to see her and came and talked with us. Very nice gentleman.
Any similarities, you think, between California Chrome and California Angel?
I think she looks like him. She looks like him, and he has some of Mr. Sherman said she has some of his mannerisms. He said, you know, she does like her daddy. Said she looks like him. She favors her daddy.
Really? How so?
Well, she's not as muscular as her daddy. Her daddy was a lot bigger horse than he is, but she's a filly. And he told me he thinks they're going to develop. He said Chrome developed more as he got older. He said he thinks she'll be the same, you know, that as she gets a little older, she's going to probably get better. Well, you know, she's got to grow, and she's going to mature a little more. I think, you know, her best is yet to come.
Well, it'd be nice if she would compare to her father, at least in bankroll, right? $14.7 million is what he made.
Well, I told her when she first won her first race, all she got to do is win a quarter of that. She don't have to do the whole thing. Just a quarter of what her daddy does is okay for me.
Yeah, you'll be very happy with that, I'm sure. Talking with George Leonard III here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. So her first start comes at Kentucky Downs, and she wins at odds of 28-1. How much did you have on her that day?
I bet what I bet on her when I bet heavy, I bet 5 across.
Fantastic. Yep. Do you normally bet your horses, George?
every now and then, not often. You know, I'm not. If I bet $100 a year, I bet a lot, and I don't ever do that. I just don't have very much interest in the gambling aspect of the game. I like the sport. It's not about making money like that, but I bet her because I couldn't believe the long odds she was going, and I thought we had an excellent chance to win.
Yeah, and she, much like that win in the Jesmond that we'll talk about in a minute, she came storming home from dead last, and she won going away by 2¾ lengths in that very first career start. And I guess when you have a purse like a maiden special weight purse of $135,000 in that race, you really don't need to be betting five across, do you?
Right. You know, your percent's going to get you through on that one.
So as she's loafing along at the back of the pack in that race, you said you were confident, but did you start to have some doubts creep in, or did you know that, okay, this is the way she's going to run?
Well, I didn't anticipate her being that far back or being behind. I was more worried about her being on the lead. Because in the morning, she shows nothing but speed just for her races. For some reason, she just doesn't come out of the gates. But in the morning, she's fast. And, you know, I was worried. And when I saw her behind, when I seen her move up to the tail of the field, I told the owner, I said, she ain't started running yet. When she is over, once she gets started, and she picked them up and just moved right around, I expected as much.
Yeah. Some people would find it interesting that a guy based at Indiana Grand ends up with Rafael Bejarano riding his horse in her first start, and then each of the next three races as well. It's the only jockey she's ever known. How did you end up with Rafael?
Well, Bejarano's always been my favorite rider. I like him. He's won a lot of races for me. He rode for me at Hoosier Park and River Downs and all over. He's been just my favorite rider. He's my go-to guy. So when I got this horse, I called his agent, who's a good friend of mine, Julio Espinoza. I said, Julio, I got a filly that you don't want to take off. When I run her, you want to ride this one. And Julio and I have a good working relationship. And he says, okay, George, if you tell me, you never told me wrong before. I said, this is one you want to ride. And he took my word and rode her, and he said, you were right again.
I remember when Rafael burst onto the scene, and he was at Turfway Park in northern Kentucky. And my goodness, George, he was winning everything that he sat on up there.
That's right. He's a magician. He can really get run out of a horse. And I always said if ever I had a derby horse, he'd be my man. Well, I don't quite have the derby horse, but I got a filly that he's the guy I give the call to.
Do you think she stays on the grass, or do you maybe take a look at the road to the Kentucky Oaks next year?
More than likely will. I'll have to see what they have for her. I'm not scared to run her on the dirt. The only reason she ended up on the grass in the first place was $135,000 purse. Other than that, I would have never just pointed her toward the grass. I pointed toward the grass in that race because the purse money was so big and thought I had a runner, and that was a spot where she needed to be.
Well, she did run on the dirt in her next start, sprinting, which was six furlongs at Churchill Downs. She was third that day, and then she comes back, stretched her out again on the turf. Interesting pattern. What led to the six furlong dirt start?
Well, the six furlong dirt race was a prep for the Jessamine. I was going to have to breeze her in between then, or I would give her a race over the dirt, get a little experience, let her see the lights, see a crowd of people for a second race. Because I hated to go directly from the maiden race into a stake. I would like to have a race in between. So when that one came up, that opportunity came up, I know she can run on the dirt. I put her in that race, get her a little experience. She came out of that race great and worked perfect to go into the Jessamine.
Yeah, it certainly did. And I say interesting pattern because not only do you go turf, dirt, turf, but you go with a route race to a sprint race back to a route race again. What's your philosophy, George, in getting these horses to stretch out? Is that a normal pattern for you?
Not as much a pattern as each horse is different.
Yep.
You know, the horse that nothing tires her. She doesn't get tired. She's got speed, and she doesn't tire easily. Actually, I've never made her tired. She's got wind to spare. So I knew that she was fast enough to be able to sprint, and I was going to have to work her in between anyway, and rather than work her, I'd get experience and another race in her.
Well, it worked to perfection for George Leonard III and for California Angel. George is joining me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. All right, George, we've waited long enough. Let's talk about that first greatest stakes victory of your career. You've been training since 1991, so 30 years. That's a long time to wait for a greatest stakes victory, but boy, did she provide it in that Grade 2 Jesmyn.
Yes, she did. She ran awesome. She ran really well. I was ecstatic. I was, you know, it's hard to believe all of my work and everything came to fruition. Everything worked. It was just an ecstatic time.
I can imagine it's pretty emotional for a trainer, too, isn't it?
It was. I mean, it was extremely emotional. You know, you think about my dad and all the things, you know, like, man, I wish my dad could be here. And, you know, everything is just emotions on top of emotions running through you, you know, joy and happiness. It's just a great time.
Yeah, we'll spend plenty of time in the second half of the program talking about your background in the early days of George Leonard III. But you bring up your father. He was a trainer too, right?
Yes. My dad. Yeah.
Is he still living, George?
No, sir. My father passed away in a car accident about 12, 14 years ago.
Yeah, I can imagine that he was definitely in your thoughts when California Angel crossed the finish line in the Jesmyn, though.
That he was. I had to keep reminding myself I'm 6'2", 235. I can't let no tears come down. It was tough.
Yeah. You know what? I think it's okay. You win that first greatest stakes. I think it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. But, you know, I had still got a reputation to uphold. I couldn't let no tears come down.
Well, speaking of the reputation, you're also most notable, I guess, or one of the things that you're known for is that signature cowboy hat. How did that come about?
Just a way of life. It's just, you know, I always wore a hat. I always liked the cowboy hat. My dad and my grandfather always wore a cowboy hat. So, you know, you always want to emulate your mentor. So just had hat like they did and just always did wear a cowboy hat. It's always been my thing.
I think every time I saw you on television or being interviewed at the Breeders' Cup, you had on that Bass Pro shirt, too. Are you an outdoorsman?
I like to fish. Yes, me and my boys like to fish, hunt. We are outdoorsmen.
Yeah, tremendous stuff. Well, he was in search of some big game in the Juvenile Phillies turf with California Angel, but she did come up short in that one. But as you heard him say earlier in the program, that she will live to fight another day, and we'll start working on her next chapter for California Angel. When I come back, I'll tell you about the next chapter of trainer George Leonard III as he talks about his background growing up in Louisiana. We'll talk a little bit more about his dad and what he learned from him, and we'll talk about some of the other horses he's been around that he's never going to forget. That's in the second half of the program. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This November, the sport's brightest stars will be offered for sale at Fasic Tipton. With a sensational catalog featuring no less than 11 champions, Breeders' Cup winners, and Classic winners. Over 30 Grade 1 winners or producers, nearly 50 graded stakes winners or producers, and over 140 selected weanlings. All this in one spectacular session. The world's premier breeding stock event, the Fasic Tipton November Sale, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Denali Stud is a perennial leading consigner with three decades of raising and selling Saturday afternoon horses.
Malathon, search results, undefeated fillies, 1-2, no to the wire. Who's going to win it? It's Malathon by a neck.
Idol perfectly timed. Idol gets up under Joel Rosario to win the big cap.
Denali sold Kentucky Oaks winner and leading distaff contender Malathon and fold raised and sold Breeders' Cup Classic contender Idol. Denali Stud, where attention to detail is standard.
Champions are returning to Gulfstream for the championship meet starting December 3rd until April 3rd. Witness the best thoroughbred racing Wednesday through Sunday with weekly stakes races. Returning for its sixth year this January is the 2022 Pegasus World Cup with world-class racing, delectable cuisine, stunning celebrities, and iconic fashion. New for 2022 is the third graded stakes race, the Pegasus Turf for fillies and mares with a $500,000 purse. Tickets go on sale November 8th. Visit PegasusWorldCup.com to learn more and get tickets.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They come off the far turn, and Turner loose, the one to catch. Rigby, then Bowman back toward the inside on the ones and twos, is in fourth as they turn for home. Dressed is fifth on the outside. Bowman tries to find an opening to the rail. It is still Turner loose with the lead. And Diamond Wow alongside with Dress coming from third. Diamond Wow, Dress stacking up outside of Turner Loose, California Angel running late. Diamond Wow, Turner Loose, California Angel coming on the far outside at the wire. Photo for the win. What a finish in the J.P. Morgan Chase Jessamine.
California Angel closing like a freight train, as they say in the sport of thoroughbred racing. It was impressive, and that was on October 13th, the Grade 2 Jessamine at Keeneland. Boy, if you're going to win your first graded stakes race, why not do it at historic Keeneland? That was our very own Kurt Becker with the call of that race. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday program, visiting with trainer George Leonard III. Going to continue that conversation momentarily, right after I remind you that if you missed any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast of this show and all of our shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, and be sure to follow us for all of the updates on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, and on Instagram. Well, George, you said that you were trying not to cry after that race. You said cowboys don't cry. Well, that's an emotional moment there. What was going through your mind as you were listening to the stretch call here coming out of the commercial break?
It still gives you chills and goosebumps. You know, it's always, you know, it's thrilling to hear the call anytime. Every time you hear it, you know, it never gets old.
The other cool thing about your story is that you're getting to do this with your family beside you. I mentioned your wife, Isabel, but when you got to Del Mar at the Breeders' Cup, you had your brother and your two sons that came from Louisiana to be with you. How special is that?
That was great. You know, my sister was also there. I had my sister, my two brothers, and my two boys. You know, nothing like your family. I have another brother. He would have came, but he had surgery, had tricep surgery, broke a tricep. He would have came, and all of them would have been there. But, you know, nothing like your family. I was so honored to have my family come and support me in the biggest race of my life.
Are they involved in racing in any way?
My second brother has a couple of horses. My other two brothers, no, they're not involved in the racing, or my sister either.
Do you train those horses for your brother?
No, my brother trains his own horses. He's got a few horses. He's got a job, like we always did growing up. He's got a job, and after he works, he does a couple of horses in the evenings.
I want to talk about more of your early days and growing up in Louisiana, but before I do, there was an article that the LA Times did about you this past week, and one quote you had in there, you said, "I'm not a trailblazer. I'd rather be a role model and be known more for my hard work than my nationality. It shows that anybody through hard work can get lucky and make it." You, George, are the first African-born black trainer ever to enter a horse in the Breeders' Cup. Talk about what that means for you personally.
Personally, you know, I'm honored, you know, and I'm glad to be recognized. But like I said, you know, I'm more like to be recognized for the hard work I did to get here. You know, my nationality is one thing, but it was the hard work and luck of getting here, you know, doing the right things and working hard and getting a break to get here.
Yeah, and California Angel provided you with that break. But you mentioned hard work, and I talk about this a lot on this program, George. Whether you're Todd Pletcher or your Steve Asmussen or your Bill Mott or whoever, Brad Cox, it doesn't matter. Anybody that's at the top of this game, you don't get there without working your tail off. And I've had Bill Mott tell me that there was a time when his horses weren't good enough to get stalls at very minor racetracks. They wouldn't even give them stalls. People don't think about Bill Mott, Todd Pletcher, Steve Asmussen, and those folks in that light, but everybody has to start somewhere. Talk about the hard work you put in.
Well, it is, you know, it's a 24/7 job. You know, it's a job 7 days a week. You know, when things are good, you're on the top of the world, but just that quick, you know, things can go down and you have so many problems. I was explaining to somebody the other day, you know, you never hear that John Doe is a really good trainer, but he's got bad help. You know, his horse is not running because he's got bad help. You're at the top. You're responsible for everything and everybody. Everybody in your operation. So, you know, it's stressful. That's why when you're winning and things are good, you know, you smile and enjoy it because, you know, it took a lot to get there. And it's a job that's timeless. You know, there's lots of time involved in being a horse trainer. You know, your phone rings. You have to stay on top of so many things, keeping up with everything. And when it's good, that's why, you know, you smile and enjoy it when things are good because, you know, it took a lot to get there.
You know, in sports, we'll often hear that a coach is only as good as his players. But I think it goes both ways. With a horse trainer, is a trainer only as good as the horses that he has in his barn, George?
90%. Yeah, you know, I mean, you can't take a bad horse and give him to somebody and they can't train him to make him run. If he doesn't have athletic ability, there's nothing you can do to fix that. You know, you're only as good as the stock you have. It's like you were saying earlier when Mr. Mott said, you know, he didn't have horses good enough to get stables on the places. You know, as a trainer, you have to put your horses at a racetrack where you can compete. You can't go to Keeneland in the big races if you don't have the horses to be able to compete there. So that has to be part of the game. Part of being a trainer is knowing where your horses fit in, putting them in the right places where you can win races at the right tracks.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than just putting the saddle on the horse and giving the jockey
right.
a leg
it
up.
It looks a lot easier than it really is. It looks very simple. Just run them around the track and put them in a race and run them. It's not that simple.
Yeah. Now, as they say, if it was easy, everyone would do it, right?
That's right.
Yeah, 100%. I mentioned you grew up in Elton, Louisiana. Now, last I checked, the population in Elton, Louisiana was about 1,300 people. I don't know, it's roughly 1,300. Tell me more about Elton.
Elton is a little small community where there's lots of farmers. They farm rice. We have a couple rice dryers. It's where they harvest the rice and put the rice in dryers. And it's a pretty much of a farm town. We got a little small school. And everybody was friendly, you know, just nice, friendly little town. Out like country life is rural, very rural. We have one store in town. Just a good place to be.
Yeah, located, what, about 60 miles northwest of Lafayette?
Yeah, about 60 miles between Lafayette and Lake Charles.
Okay. And you described yourself this week as being more Creole than Cajun. What's the difference?
Creole is... We're a little mixed. We have mixed nationalities. I have a little bit of everything in me. When you see my dad, you would know he's my dad. My dad looked completely different than I did. We have some mannerisms that are the same, but, you know, we're not African-American and we're not as white as the Cajuns. So we're just kind of like a mixed people, and they call those mixed people a Creole people.
Okay. And Cajun would be what?
Cajun was more of, it's too French. Creole is French, and the Cajun was French as well. But the Cajuns were more of the white people. They were like pure white people, and they called themselves the Cajuns.
Okay.
And the Creole people were the mixed people, mixed nationality.
Okay, gotcha. So what's your favorite Creole cuisine?
Gumbo.
Yeah. Do you make a mean gumbo?
I don't make it. I'm very good at eating it. My mom does the best cooking and my wife, and I'm just the best eater. I just eat it very well.
And that's why you're, what, 6'3"? Is that what you said?
6'2".
6'2".
6'2", about 235.
Now, you grew up playing sports, too, in Louisiana, right?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
What sports?
I played basketball, football, softball, ran track. We were pretty busy.
How did you ever get time to work with the horses, too?
Well, we did that in between school, and you play ball, run back home, do this, and run back to track practice, baseball practice, basketball practice, get all in between.
Did you ever think that you might do something else other than horses?
Not really. It's what I always wanted to do. I've had a couple other little jobs in between when I first got married and a couple of other things, but that never made me happy. I knew this is what I always wanted to do.
Tell me more about your dad and his training regimen and how he handled his business, because he would saddle horses at, what, at Delta Downs and Evangeline?
Mm-hmm. My dad had a job and five kids, so he would go to work. We'd get up in the morning, feed. He'd go to work for 7. We'd go to school. After he got off at 4 o'clock, he came back home. We got back at 3:30 on the bus. Everybody runs to the barn and start cleaning stalls and saddling horses, and we galloped and trained and put horses in turbulators and worked till 9-10 o'clock at night, go home, do homework, grab a bite to eat, and start again on weekends. It was time to go to the races. When we get a horse in here or there, we go to the races on weekends.
Well, so he taught you everything you know about horses then?
Yes, sir, pretty much everything I know my dad taught me. You know, we worked daily, every day at the barn.
What do you think he would have said if he could have been there at Keeneland with you when California Angel won the Jesmond?
He'd have been ecstatic. I don't know. It's hard to say what he would have said. He'd have been proud. He just said, "That's my boy, I'm sure." And he would give me a big hug. My dad was big on giving you a big, tight hug and been super proud.
Did he ever have that big horse come along in his career?
We won a couple maturities, which is a older stakes race for quarter horses in Texas. We won the Southwest Texas Derby with the horse, and that was one of my dad's bigger wins. You know, we had quarter horses to start, and we won a couple of those in Texas. We won a couple of those maturities, and he was pretty pleased with that.
Yeah, it sounds to me, in listening to you describe what your days were like as a child, that your dad was not only a teacher, but he was a strict disciplinarian, keeping everybody in line too, to make sure that you guys were doing it the right way. What kind of teacher was he, George?
My dad was strict. He was strict, you know, and we worked from, we never had, when I got to college and I was talking to a few of my friends, they had been to jail for this and jail for that, you know, little minor things. And they asked me, they said, "George, you ever go to jail?" I made him laugh. I said, "I never had time to go to jail. Our dad always had us too busy, you know. You never had no time for horseplay. We were busy. Kept you working, you know, cleaning stalls and working on these horses, you know, from the time you get up to the time you go to sleep. So there was no time for nothing to get into no trouble."
Why do you think you were the sibling that decided to pursue a career in horse racing as a trainer?
I don't know. I think it worked out for me. My brother trained a few horses a little while, which he did all right with his horses and stuff too, but then he decided to go off into something else, and he wanted the insurance and stuff for his kids and things, and it just stuck with me, and it just been my passion, what I really, really love to do. For me, I never work a day in my life, and I get up 7 days a week, you know, and go to the barn, but it's what I love to do. It's not going to work for me.
Yeah, it's you have to have a passion for it, and you have to love what you do to be a horse trainer. But as you said, so many trainers will come on this show and tell me the same thing. Like you just said, George, they never worked a day in their life because this is it's what they love to do. They wouldn't want to do anything else.
Right, it's an exhilarating feeling. That feeling of being in the winner's circle is unmatched. When you win a $5,000 race, it's as exhilarating. I mean, everyone, you have a passion for that win. It's like a high that's unmatched high to win races. When you win, there's no better feeling.
We have owned pieces. My wife and I have owned pieces of a few different horses over the years, and we've been very, very fortunate. All but one has won a race, and that feeling is indescribable. And I've always said, George, if you could take it and bottle it, the feeling of winning a race, watching your horse cross the finish line, this would be the most popular sport in the world, hands down.
No doubt. No doubt. It's just exhilaration that you can't, unmatched feeling of winning.
So when you began your training career in 1991, how did that all come about? Did you just jump right into it? Did you do some things before that? How did that all work out?
Well, I worked for a couple guys before I actually took out my own trainer's license. And excuse me, when I took out my trainer's license, I had one or two horses, and a couple of my friends told me you're going to starve, but I just put my head down and kept working, and then I got a couple more, and it just worked out for me, and I've been blessed to just always keep a few horses, and it's been really tough times sometimes, but it always found a way to get out, and everything worked out for the best.
There have been a lot of trainers over the years that have told me on this show that they have won with their very first starter, and hey, they thought the game was easy at that point. That wasn't the case for you. You had to race, what, about 35 different horses before you finally got that first one home in the winner's circle. Was it tough at that point to keep the faith and to keep pushing and keep doing this?
No, like I said, it was my passion. You know, I loved what I do. I know it was going to win races, but it's and when you start with lesser horses, I had to take the horses other people didn't want and try to patch them up, you know, and get them well and fix things, you know, to be able to get a horse to the races. So it made it a lot tougher, but, you know, it just, your sustainability, you know, that I was going to do this no matter what, that I wouldn't give up until I got to be where I wanted to be.
If I'm not mistaken, that first win came at, what, Evangeline Downs, or was it Delta Downs?
I think my first win was at Jefferson Downs.
Jefferson Downs, okay.
Jefferson Downs, a horse named Nickamore.
You never forget that first one.
Nope, never forget your first win.
Yeah, so special. And there have been so many top moments for my special guest, George Leonard III, since that first win, including his first trip to the Breeders' Cup. You heard him talk about that in the first half of the program. Again, if you did miss it, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can listen to the podcast of this entire visit. It has really been a delight. George, did you have, outside of your father, were there other trainers that you looked up to or would follow when you first got into the business?
Yes, there was. I had a mentor and a man named C.D. Delahoussie. They called him Papa C. Papa C was, I learned more from him than anybody. He was the best teacher I ever had. I mean, I stayed with him some years, and, you know, he had horses, and he came with me when I first came to Ohio. He came with me here. He had a few horses, and I had a few. He taught me how to survive, how to make it in the game. He was, I got to give him more credit than anybody. He really showed me a lot. I learned a tremendous amount from him. He was the best horseman I'd ever been around, and he really showed me a lot. I owe him many things. He died maybe 15 years ago. He was like a second father to me. And I mean, he was truly a mentor to me.
What made him such a good horseman?
He didn't have much education, but he was very smart. You know, he watched a horse. He showed me what you have to watch in a horse, where to put a horse in a race to win races. He was really a student of the game. He'd been doing it all of his life, seen many, many people, you know, many horses, and he showed me what it took to put a horse in the right place to win races, how to choose the horse. You know, he was just a smart guy, very smart.
What was the moment in your career that eventually led you to kind of go to the next level, George?
to the next level, meaning
that. Yeah, meaning, you know, you're starting out, you're grinding it out with, you know, low level claimers, and you're fighting and scratching and clawing, and then all of a sudden something happens and you go, boy, you know what, I can actually, this is going to be a thing, I can make a living doing this.
There never was a point when I still have cheap claimers. There was never a point, you know, where I like elevated my game to another level. I was second leading trainer and leading trainer once at Turfway, tied for leading trainer at Turfway once, and second leading trainer a couple times. But my game pretty much stays the same, you know. It never was no big move up from one degree to another degree. This point in my life right here, the Breeders' Cup thing has been a step up. This has been a great time, but the rest of it has all been pretty much even keel.
What is the key to being a good horse trainer, George?
I think understanding each horse. Every horse is different. I think you have to look at each horse as an individual. There's not one way to train all of them. You have to find what each horse likes. For me, it's like a game of chess. I love the training aspect, is to find what each horse likes, what his niche is, what makes him go. And, you know, it's interesting because they're like a bunch of kids. Each one is different. They all have different personalities, and you can't train them all the same. Some love to train every day, and some you train them every day, they don't eat. So you have to find happy medium for each one. I think that's what it takes to and keeping a horse happy. Find what keeps him happy, and I think that makes for a good trainer.
How do you describe California Angel's personality, and what makes her happy?
California Angel is bittersweet. She likes you, and then she'll bite you. She's just, you never can tell what she's going to do. She'll let you pet her for a minute, then the next minute she's going to bite you. She loves to train. She's a horse that really loves to go to the track. When you don't send her to the track, she's miserable in the stall. So I keep her very busy all the time. She likes her training. She eats well. She's very professional. When you leave out of the barn, she doesn't do a jumping around, you know, with the rider stuff. She's right to task and focused.
You know, I'm going to take California Angel out of the equation for this next question, George, because I love to ask trainers this question on this show. When you hear about a golfer, a lot of times a golfer will come on and they'll talk about the best shot they ever hit in their career, and they can remember it vividly. A baseball player will talk about, you know, the best swing, the best moment when they saw that pitch and boom. How about for you? Is there a singular training job that you have done with a horse that you would say, you know, man, I did some really good work with this horse. This might be my best ever training job.
I had a horse named Point Finish that really, really, and we claimed him for $7,500. He made a couple hundred thousand after that. He won the claiming crown, won a stake 2 weeks after that. He was probably my best trainer accomplishment.
Yeah, it's not always the ones that get the headlines, right?
Nope, they don't. You know, he was low-level claimer, but he come up and he just won all kind of races, won the claiming crown, won a couple minor stakes. He was just a very nice horse. Also, I have another nice starter horse in Zanesville, a horse I claimed for $5,000. He's won about 10 races in a year. He's been a star as well.
Yeah, this has been a fantastic visit. We're coming up on the final 5 or 6 minutes now, George. And, you know, you think about your story, and we have touched on it throughout this hour here this morning, and I mentioned the David versus Goliath thing, and we can look at it in a bunch of different ways. The underdog taking on the big boys at the Breeders' Cup. Regardless, it was a dream come true. It's a moment that you're never going to forget. Nobody can ever take it away from you. What gets me is that owner Chris Walsh, we talked about her and the small breeding operation she has in Indiana. The two of you team up. You buy California Angel for $5,500. She wins the Grade 2 Jessamine at Keeneland. The next day, Walsh got an offer for $500,000 for the filly, and they politely declined. They walked away from the money. And that, to me, George, is so amazing that, you know, a small operation like hers, like yours, would just say, you know what? Forget it. We don't want the money. This is about more than the money.
That's right. You know, she, I was very pleased, you know, that she decided, you know, she never had any interest in selling the filly. You know, she says, we're going to enjoy this ride. She says, you know, we sell her, we're going to buy more horses, and we may never have another one like her. I want to just enjoy the ride with this one. You know, let's just have fun. And I said, I have no problem with that at all. That's perfect for me.
Yeah, and that ride is not finished yet. As you mentioned, she will get a little time now, give her a bit of a break, and then start looking toward 2022 and what could be ahead for California Angel. She is ultra-talented, and she is in the hands of somebody who knows a thing or two about taking care of his horses. That is George Leonard III, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. George, what do you think you might be doing if you weren't training horses right now?
And that is very hard to say, to be honest. You know, as if I wasn't training horses, I don't know what I'd be doing. I'm sure something with horses. I'd probably have cattle for them, cattle or something. I like cattle as well. I'd like to ride. I'd probably have cattle and maybe a cattle farm if I wasn't horse training.
You mentioned that you played football and baseball and basketball, ran track when you were growing up in Louisiana. Are there other sports that you will follow or other things you like to do when you get away from the track a little bit?
I enjoy the rodeos a lot, too. I would like to rope, you know, and when I retire someday, I'd like to rope and do a couple amateur ropings and things like that. I like rodeos and cowboy things and stuff like that. I do enjoy those things.
You ever have a chance to sit down and talk with Carl Nasker?
There's one guy I didn't meet. I didn't meet Mr. Nasker, no.
Yeah, one heck of a guy, and one heck of a bull rider, too.
No kidding, huh?
Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame, the Bull Riding Hall of Fame.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, how about that? So he's not only in the Horse Racing Hall of Fame, he's in the Bull Riding Hall of Fame.
No kidding.
Yeah, he's a great guy, great story. If you ever get a chance to say hi to him, make sure you do it. George, listen, it has been an absolute delight to hear your story. We're just about out of time, but want to wish you all the best going forward with California Angel and all the horses that you have in your care. And, you know, listen, keep it rolling, my friend. It's a wonderful story.
Thank you, and thank you for having me and sharing my story. I appreciate it.
All right, George Leonard III here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Real classy guy, too, huh? I mean, just to listen to him talk and... Boy, so honest about everything, and he came from not much. He wasn't born into the game with a silver spoon in his mouth by any stretch of the imagination. He worked his tail off, and here he is alongside his wife, Isabel, and they end up at the Breeders' Cup, a dream come true with California Angel. Good for them. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, head to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. Follow us on social media at HRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and Instagram. For my producer, Lee Della Pina, for my special guest, George Leonard III, I'm Mike Penna. You've been listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everybody.